Thank you. I find it really always ironic that when I go to Montreal, everybody starts calling me Roger. This is it's hilarious.
Because it's Roger. Okay.
No, it's really funny. Because I train the Anglo-Canadians now to sell. Call me Roger, and I'm very successful at that. And I come to Montreal, the moment I get out of the train, everybody starts calling me Roger. That's all right. Just I hope that I won't, put you to sleep at the end of this long afternoon. I would like to thank the organizers for having me along for this ride. I'm enjoying this very much, but I'm neither a philosopher nor a political theorist. I am a very practical political economist, and I also do some urban political ecology, which you won't see today. But what I do is very hands-on most of the time, even though I have been doing some theory, but along the way. What you hear today is part of the beginning, a very tiny sliver of the beginning of a large research project that we got funding for last year. It's an MCRI, a major collaborative research initiative on global suburbanisms, in the plural, and three subsets, sub-themes, governance, land, and infrastructure. You're going to hear today about a bit about the governance aspect, for which I'm partly responsible, and also your local hero here, Pierre Hamel, who is currently in Paris, who has done considerable work with me on this in the past few years. So some credit goes to him, and also to Mike Eckers, who we co-wrote a paper with, on which a theoretical paper on which this is based. Now, it's great when you're an academic and you get some funding, but it's even better when the best rock band of the century is providing the soundtrack. So we got the funding in April. They put out this great album in May. This is fantastic. So this is, of course, the local band, one of the local bands. Of course, I do know that Montreal has more prodigal sons than the Arcade Fire, and more successful bands come out of here than any other Canadian city. Normally, if I had time, I would play you some music, and I don't have the time. But it's important to note that, you know, with all the many decades that we've been doing work on the suburbs and that we've had television series about the suburbs, a group of young people, youngish people, they're not that young, puts out this iconic album, it's a programmatic album which deals with the suburbs. So there's something about the suburbs that doesn't seem to want to go away. And they put it out in the most urban city in Canada, in the most urbane city in Canada, the city which thinks of itself as being the most non-suburban city in Canada. I find all these contradictions great, but nevertheless, they are, of course, hitting on something here, which is the fact that, as most of us know, in 2006, 2007, at some point, we crossed the divide and we're now an urban world. More than half of the urban population is urban. I don't want to get back to the Lefebvre debate, but that part of that is, of course, in there. We're now not only have not just reached the age of urbanization, we're not in an urban age, we're also in an urban world, so there's this historical and geographical aspect to it. So this is actually something that Lefebvre did discuss in the 60s, and he did discuss it with Mao Zedong on the other side of the debate, because Mao's understanding, of course, was about the fact that we are heading to a majority rural world in which we would live a completely different kind of life, and he debated him on that. So, but in reality, this is where we are right now. But what we're arguing, of course, in our research project is that the majority of the existing urbanization that we see on this map and the majority of what is currently emerging as urbanization is not really urbanization. It's not what you see out of the window here, but it is suburbanization. So the majority of people in the world right now live in suburbs and will live in what we call suburbs, and that we can talk a bit more about. This is the ultimate suburban symbol, which is Los Angeles, of course, which, by the way, is the third densest city in North America. So there are all these contradictions here. But this is what most people would associate when I say the word suburb, that image pops up in your mind. But in our project, what we mean is very different kinds of suburbs. So for example, we have Mitchell's Plain in Cape Town. We have the view from the Oriental Pearl Tower in Shanghai. We have Singapore, and we have Brno in Slovakia, which all forms of suburbanization. So we're not just thinking of the single family home type suburbs that normally are associated with that. We're looking at all these different forms and more that I couldn't even represent. Just wanted to give you some example that I'm not just talking about what normally is being talked about as the North American model of suburbanization. Now, in Canada, we have had mostly two kinds, and you know, there are several forms that this takes, but there are two kinds of suburbs. One is this here, which is the sprawl, and that is about 3 kilometers north of where I work at York University in the city of Vaughan. That's typical for, takes different kinds of forms. These kinds of dog houses look differently in Vancouver than they look in, or in Toronto from Montreal and from Halifax, but what you get is this kind of single family home sea. And the other thing is actually the view out of my window at York University. And those of you who have been at York know that York is at the suburban fringe of metropolitan Toronto, which nobody in Toronto calls that thing region, hasn't in 20 years. So that of the city of Toronto, the amalgamated city of Toronto at the very northwestern fringe. When I look out the window, I see this. So that is another form of suburbanization, which Canada is, of course, very famous for. That is the high-rise dominated fringe of mostly Toronto, but also, I can see that here in Montreal. I can see it when I drive north of here to Quebec along the highway in the smaller cities. They have these same types of suburbs. So that's the form that it has taken in this country. And recently, we can see there are three kinds of changes in that form, or in that societal mishmash that we see. The first is the suburbanization has become more diverse. Secondly, there is something which hasn't come up much in this conference, which is neoliberalization, which has changed our collective lives quite dramatically over the last generation. That has led to certain splintering effects in infrastructure provision, and in services, and that has led to, and I'll explain that in a second, to something I would call in-between cities. And thirdly, there have been aggressive suburban regimes that use their political base in the suburbs to fundamentally shift the meaning of metropolitan politics in Canada, and as we could see on Monday, also nationally. So the first thing is that we have more diversity. Things are changing rapidly. Immigrants now don't move to the little Italys and little Portugals of inner cities and then happen to move out in the second generation to buy a house in the suburbs. No, they move directly to ethnoburbs and newly diversified immigrant suburbs. This is one of them. This is the town of Markham with 300,000 people. You can see that the dark shaded areas have 100% visible minorities. That's a huge number. It's a huge percentage of people who are not Anglo, for which this city was used to be famous. It was an Anglo little Anglo town. But this is only one. There's Brampton and Mississauga, and a whole bunch of ex-urban neighborhoods around Toronto. The second change that is what I already referred to as the in-between city. German planner by the name of Tom Sieverts wrote a book by that name, Die Zwischenstadt, which came out in English in 2003 in Routledge, Cities Without Cities. And that is that mixed morphology that you now see. And I would argue, and we have argued this in a book that was published yesterday, so there are some brochures there. It's in the back, a little plug. You can download it for free as a PDF, the entire book, from Praxis ePress. So have a look at this. I can give you the information. A whole bunch of colleagues from around Canada, across Canada, have written in this book. So we can now say that the majority of Canadians probably live, work, or play in this kind of in-between city where you don't really know whether you're in the suburbs or in the inner city. A lot is happening there. There's a lot of mix. I don't have time to speak much about that today. But what it means, it conceptually forces us to give up on the exactly that dichotomy that we talked so much about over the last couple of days. City, suburbs. That's not happening in between cities. Something else is going on here. Thirdly, we have an aggressively suburban political dynamic that has been shown in a mayoral election in Toronto, where a new mayor was elected who happens to also be a partisan conservative. But more importantly, he was somebody who espouses suburban political values, and the blue shaded areas here were those areas where the majority of polls went to him. The pink where Smitherman, a liberal candidate, was voted for, that was the inner city, and there was also a third candidate who was associated with the NDP by the name of Joe Pantalone. So he got very few wins there, and don't actually show up on this map. So the short, I was going to bring another map, but I couldn't technically do it because the ones that they currently have on the CBC and other websites are too complicated to put in a PowerPoint show. And I didn't want to waste more time. But if you look at the CBC site, you see how interesting now that in the federal election this has played out in much different ways. So there is next, in that newness is a new type of politics emerging. I'm going to read you a bit about this. And I like Frank's anecdote yesterday about Jack Diamond, who thought his city hall was going to solve the Mideast crisis. I'm not going to talk about Israel here. This is just an example. The example I give is symbolic. I have not done much research on this. I'm just going to, take it at face value. Okay, so there are these three cases that I'm going to quickly run by you. So in the spring of 2011, the town of Markham, the one which we just saw, a municipality of about 300,000, became a battleground of a quite unusual kind. Quiet state developmental politics, as usual, were interrupted as city council was debating to ban Israeli apartheid week from the municipality. Although there was really no such campaign in the municipality of Markham at the time, the debate was prompted by the proximity of York University, where such politics were more naturally at home. But the York connection was only one aspect of the local political theater, as was the town's traditional conservative and pro-Israel political leanings. More importantly, as Jenny Pito has explained in an article, Israeli Apartheid Week affected the town of Markham because of its remarkable degree of entanglement with networks of global political economies, immigration, and corporate strategies. The core of these entanglements has been the outsourcing of public transit to French multinational Veolia, which runs the town's buses under the name Viva. You see the bus here, and you see a Veolia truck. While Viva was in the news in the past months due to a tough labor dispute with its drivers, the same company also stands on a contract in Israel to provide services to commuters and transports waste from illegal settlements on the West Bank. Here lay the deeper cause for the sensitivities of Markham citizens around the rather removed issue of Israeli Apartheid Week. Evidently, a chord was struck here that went beyond the normal confines of suburban politics. As an unusually internationalized city, Markham was a canvas of contradictions that was looking for local solutions that could not easily be had. Conservative and modernizing, regressive and hyper-developmentalist, innovative and preservationist. Globalized demographically and through its networks, the town represents a new type of suburban reality in which governance was retooled. That's the first case. I'll give you the other ones quickly. During the 2011 federal election recently, the suburbs became a strategic battleground. At first glance, this seemed like a replay of the 1990s campaigns, especially in Mike Harris's Ontario. When white middle-class voters in conservative ridings north of Toronto formed the power base of a staunchly neoliberal Tory government. Now, the voters in the suburbs that have been the toast of the campaign are new immigrants, visible minorities, and the elderly. The contentious term ethnic voters has been virtually synonymous as political, synonymous, uh, no, this is wrong. The content has been virtually ubiquitous as political leaders stomped suburbs like Surrey, Brampton, and Markham in search of exoticized cultural festivals and religious community events where they could ply their trade. The role of suburban Toronto in the federal political game has shifted accordingly as issues such as social conservatism, immigration and settlement, and pension concerns have risen to the top of the list in terms of issues and concerns, hoping they would resonate with a local diverse electorate. The point I was going to make, which I can't, is the game isn't as easy as it looked. It's true that this game led to some Tory seats or conservative seats in the periphery of Toronto, but there are also some other things happening which we maybe can take up in a debate. So the third point I wanted to quickly make is now also issues that were considered inner city issues like poverty is now moving to the suburbs. I'll leave it at that. There's talk about priority neighborhoods in the suburbs. I'll leave you with all this. There's another reference to the Arcade Fire. The point here in that quote from the song The Sprawl is, let's take a drive through the sprawl, through these towns they built to change. Now that leads to, and I'm wrapping this up quickly, but that leads to the central contradiction that we now find in suburban politics, which is that we have a contradiction between suburbanization as a process and suburbanism as a way of life. And so the people who now live in the suburbs are not the people that the suburbs were built for, and the social structures that now exist in the suburbs are not compliant with what we thought the suburbs were. So we have a fundamental issue of governance here. In there's a lot more I could say about how that fits very well with sort of the current neoliberal Canada and governmentality of that neoliberal Canada. Two things have to suffice here. What is happening here in suburban governance, it has to do two kinds of things. It has to do justice to the differentiation of the suburbs. At the same time, it has to do justice to the convergence of global suburbanization. That global process that's happening around the world, which gives us new forms of life, mostly built around the automobile and other things, is differentiated locally, and that's what has to happen, what needs to be done. And we do this, and that's where I'm going to end this, and I can send you the paper if you want to. We look at this through three modalities: the state, capital accumulation, and forms of authoritarian action. Mostly, we're getting back to this issue of private space, gated communities. And I say capital accumulation, not the market, because we want to say here is an actor there which moves through space and is being governed in particular ways. So the state, capital, and these modalities are, of course, intertwined. These are compatible arenas in which various instruments and technologies of suburban governmentality are being produced. And the state has acted mostly in symbiosis with the property industry in pushing suburbanization as a self-propelling outcome of governance. And that leads, and that's the important dynamic part, to new expectations about certain suburban ways of life, which to some people like Rob Ford and these people is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because they think that the suburbs are there for them to consume them in particular ways, which means that drivers have different rights on the road than cyclists, and. So there's certain claims come from being suburban, and that becomes then, sort of pulled over the entire urban governance debate. So suburbia is emergent, but the interesting thing is that as it used to be an open space, a space close to nature, a space of possibility where you raise your families, it becomes now more like a camp. I won't give you the whole Agamben thing here, but that of course plays into this. Now they're enclosed, sequestered, fenced, and secured, and we have a completely different kind of suburbia. So there, what we have is somewhat of an ideal form of neoliberal governance that is emerging here. And the main point is the last one here, probably, that we have a new centrality of suburban politics in the metropolis. So I would, argue against that idea that we have two different kinds, like a central and a suburban kind of politics, but we now have a new modality emerging, and that looks somewhat like that. It's an arts project at York University by my colleague Janine Marsh-Assault, Leona Drive Project. You can look it up online. And I thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
I'm sure this is a sort of part of this much larger and evolving project, but and feel free not to talk about this if you want. I'm wondering if you could say a few words about a sort of tantalizing idea you just mentioned in passing about suburbanism as a way of life and its sort of characteristic features. Is it is this evoking a kind of Simmel and Wirth and Via Lefebvre? What do you have in mind with that part of the project?
Yeah, it is. Of course, evoking this, I mean, it's a play with that tradition, urbanism as a way of life. And it also, as you pointed it out exactly, it is a hint at Lefebvre and the whole debate about everyday life. It is, we have one of the sub-projects, actually two or three, but one is actually named that way, it's called Everyday Suburbanism. So we will have anthropologists that are part of the project immerse themselves, or their students immerse themselves in, for example, Vietnam in high-rise suburban neighborhoods where new forms of life are actually emerging, where people they ply their trade in the, you know, there are all kinds of new businesses in the ground floors of these apartment buildings. New forms of market and state interaction happening in these places. And that is clearly, I mean, it's an empirical thing, but we also hope that the empirical will then sort of reflect back on perhaps saying something meaningful and keen at the theoretical level about suburbanism as a way of life, the way, you know, our heroes did it 80 years ago about Chicago. So perhaps there is something in there that will come from this. But at the beginning of the project, it's difficult to say, but clearly you hit it right on the nail on the head. Yeah.
So I just wonder, two things actually. The first is, what's your story, or how does your story interact with the urban resurgence of, say, the last 20 years, which is the sort of the recolonization of the city by folks who were formerly suburban? And we've seen some benefits of that for formerly sort of declining cities, especially in the United States. I don't know if that's what's happened in Canada too.
40 years.
Yeah, so maybe a longer trajectory. And then, how do these? And I'd be interested if you think there's a suburbanization of the city too happening, or some right? How these things are converging, the city and the suburbs, in just in terms of how it's being recolonized. And then the second question is sort of a question about the approach, which is I didn't hear much about agency. So people don't seem to have agency in this story. There are a lot of forces at work. And I just wonder what the role of, say, preferences are, to how you see preferences, how they're shaped, in terms of these choices and how powerful they are compared to these other things, these, say, the structural forces. And that relates back to the urban resurgence, because I think people are expressing preferences by coming back in.
Yeah, great questions. Urban resurgence, reurbanisierung, reurbanization is on everybody's mind. I've just published an article in a special issue in a planning journal on reurbanization. It's everywhere. It's often linked to ideas like the creative city. It's often linked to ideas of the festival city. This, you know, just go and walk down the street and then you have reurbanization. People come here. But there, you know, that's one aspect of this huge process of urbanization. That's one that's clearly being talked about more over the last maybe 10 years. And despite the fact, Nick, that it's been going on for much longer, people haven't talked about it for that long. I mean, there's been some talk about it since the 1980s, museums and, you know, all these sort of things. That's a very tiny part of what's going on. You know, if you go to the United States, there are a few cities. I was just in Seattle 2 weeks ago, and I was there the first time in 1981. I remember that as a student, and that was the first time I saw a market like the Pike Place Market. And nothing has changed there. The homeless people are still hanging out in the street. And as much, I mean, it's a very small part. If you go to a place like Pittsburgh, there's just one tiny little thing that's re-urbanized, and there's nothing beyond it. I mean, it's one aspect of it. And of course, It's more interesting nowadays to travel to a place like Boston or Seattle and also Vancouver and Montreal and Toronto than it was perhaps 30 years ago. That is true, but it has, it's not quantitatively and qualitatively, it's not in any way comparable to what has been going on around these cities. And so the centrifugal effects of the post-Fordist period of capital accumulation have been incredible. So if you want to see what's really going on, you go to Brampton, just around the Pearson Airport in Toronto, or to the northern suburbs of Frankfurt, or you can go to Istanbul and travel 10 kilometers outside of Istanbul, 20 kilometers outside of Istanbul, you're still in the city, and you have this tremendous wave of suburbanization, which hasn't been noted much in that other debate, in the Florida-inspired debate around the central city. And that is true now not only for those sprawling cities, the ones I mentioned, but it's now also true for cities like Amsterdam. It's true for cities like Copenhagen. It's true for those cities that we have historically identified with urban to begin with. It is true for Prague, which attracts millions of visitors each year to see a medieval city core. But if you get on the streetcar and go to the end of the streetcar line, you end up in huge housing estates that were built in the communist era, but are now being expanded even more. Vienna is another example, which has this ring, and everybody thinks of it as the most urban city in Europe. But in reality, if you look at Austria from the top, you see the malls and the sprawl going into the valleys everywhere. So this is an interesting development where I wouldn't discount reurbanization, but I would also think, let's also talk about the other thing. And our project just happens to be about the other thing, and it doesn't discount. There's one tiny little answer on top of that is that a lot of what's going on in those places, like around here or in downtown Toronto, is actually not reurbanization, but it's a suburbanization of the downtown. So it's the cleaning of these places. And then all of you have heard this argument. I don't need to make more of it. The second point about agency. Agency is everywhere in this project. Methodologically, as we involve people, this is just was a conceptual paper. I'm running, as part of this project, an outfit called the Greater Toronto Suburban Working Group, which is, and I've learned a lot, now John has left, I've learned a lot today from John's expose about how to get people around the table to talk, because this is a group which will meet for 3 years. We have had three meetings now every 2 months, and these are people, stakeholders from around the region, from private sector, public sector, academics, movement people, that will be in the same room without any pressure on, there is no project that we discuss. But what we're trying to find out is what are the kinds of agency that we need to look for. What are this idea of a modality? What are the processes that we need to nurture to come to different kinds of result in a process of suburbanization, which we believe not because we are structural Marxists, which we some of us also are, but which in reality is pre-structured as. The imagination of what is developable, for example, in Toronto, and how it should be developed, is pre-structured by the development industry and by local politicians and by planners and by academics who think that certain things should happen in a particular way. So we want to throw a wrench in there through our agency, and that's intellectual agency on the one hand, but it's a very practical agency, and it's quite interesting to see what has already emerged out of this. That's just a little workshop, but we do a whole bunch of other things as we move along. This is not yet at the empirical stage, we're still at the conceptual stage, and we are, in the end, running all kinds of focus groups and, looking at actual agency on the ground, so that will be taken care of. But thanks for the question.
Well, this is a question that grows out of your discussion of the in-between city. So one way to view, there's two ways, I guess, to view the relationship between the city, the in-between city, or the in-between suburb and the suburb, or however you put it. One is that you used to have two close to each other boxes. Now you've got three close to each other boxes. Now that's one view. The other view is that, and I'm gathering this would be yours, is that is suggested by your comment that the in-between city, people in the in-between suburb or city, and it could be called a city or a suburb, have some interests in common with the city and some in common with the suburbs. And that suggests that that there could be a gradation. And you don't have three boxes. You've got gradations, and you've got a complex web of sometimes shared, sometimes divergent interests, culture, and so on. And the reason that this strikes me is really important to know which of these models is reflects the reality is that if it's with the gradation model, it might be possible to combat the right wing, which has always, starting at the provincial level with Harris, then the municipal level with Ford, and now with Harper federally, played off the city versus the suburbs, exacerbated and sometimes even created hostilities, both cultural and in terms of structures and interests and so on. And as long as that can be done, I just don't see any hope for getting out from under the thumb of those governments. And if, like me and I gather you, we don't like those governments and what they're doing to the country and to urban regions, then that seems really important to be able to find ways that you can make appeal, and maybe your workshop would help to do this, to make appeal that cut across the three boundaries rather than setting them against one another.
Yeah, this is a very good observation. The this is not, even though it's tempting to see it that way, it's not like the third Italy, right? It's not like there are two Italies and there's a rich one and a poor one and there's one in the middle. The idea is that, again, in answer to the second question, the city's core has gotten a lot of attention, not only by funders and investors and capital accumulation and all this, and by political forces, but also by academics. We write a lot about the city center, and people write a lot about gentrification in the city center. It's a hot topic. Condo boom. These things are, you know, that's one thing. The second thing is that the suburbs, the exurbs, and the suburbs have gotten a lot of attention. Also by certain types of investment, mostly private investment, and that's another thing. I didn't want to give you that answer, but now I'm giving it to you anyway, the question of agency. Of course, the development industry says the people want to live in the suburbs, so we built them those. That's agency, right? They go into the marketplace and they build those things. So that's another thing that has a lot of light on it. There's a spotlight on those suburbs, and there are shiny new malls, and there are shiny new highways, and they lead to shiny new factories that are tied into the just-in-time production of the global economy. That's the other thing. So these two things are the glamour zones of the urban region. And in between is this huge swath of undefined land. That's what you see out of my window at York University. You know, warehouses, railway lands, Canada's largest urban national park, any type, any manner of things that don't actually fit together. And we, you know, for example, wrote a piece on the gas explosion, the propane gas explosion, which is right in the middle of that. It's in our, you know, in that area that we looked at under this last project here for Infrastructure Canada. There happened to be a huge propane gas facility right next to a post-war suburb, right in the middle. So how could that be? Why would there be, you know, something like that as a historical product, while the glamour zones in the downtown and out in the suburbs, we would never allow for that kind of in-betweenness and mix, right? For that danger at your doorstep, right? So it's that thing. The gradient doesn't work so well because there are some aspects that are qualitatively different. Politically, to give you an example, it really depends on what kind of politics you're dealing with. We looked at infrastructure. So I'll give you an example of the subway. The subway is now being built out into no man's land there in Vaughan. It ends on a parking lot in front of a Walmart. And that is where Vaughan will develop a huge urban center. But the urban center will be a big box retail kind of urban center with a bit of offices and all that eventually. What we are saying is that the subway, to some degree, connects the glamour zones. It connects the parking lots of the outer region with the functions of the inner city. But the subway cuts through without even thinking about, for a moment, about what it cuts through. It cuts through 15 kilometers of in-between city where nobody really knows what's going on. What is going to be at that subway? Well, we know there is a university, my university, there is a big urban park, and. But there is not really a concept here, there is not really a political discourse around who is being connected. The only thing we know is that in reality, the subway passes by those in-between communities. Those in-between communities should have had, as you know, and as you have said, and we've heard before, that those in-between communities should have more of this kind of a network, a transit city kind of a network that actually takes seriously the particular socio-spatial, or the spatiality, to use the term of this conference. To bring justice to that spatiality, you would need a different kind of a infrastructure concept than the one that is now being proposed both by the York subway, which I like a lot, thank you very much, because it takes me to my work, but also the subways that are now being proposed. So this is an example of how the in-between city itself is bypassed physically, but also discursively and politically, and does not create a basis, an agenda, an arena for agency of those people to actually come out and say, this is what we need, this is what we want. We need this density of urbanity here rather than being bypassed to connect one premium network space with another premium network space. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
So my question is kind of a devil's advocate question. But I noted the fact that you showed a map of Toronto that was not the exact same one that I showed, but it was very similar. And basically, it represented the three Torontos and the fact that poverty is increasingly concentrated in the inner suburbs of Scarborough and North York. And it made me think, if gentrification is a harm, then is the opposite, degentrification, a benefit or a positive thing? So we don't really have a good term for it, but let's call it proletarianization or something. So if the proletarianization of the inner suburbs is the opposite of gentrification, then doesn't it in some ways do good things, that the cost of housing decreases in that area, right? If you look at the charts the real estate agents periodically put out, these areas, cost of housing has actually gone down, or at least been stable and not increased like the rest of the city, and rents are fairly low, more comparable to, you know, more remote areas. And there's also opportunities for small ethnic businesses to set up in these abandoned strip mall plazas, and even in some of the larger malls. There's, I think, in Scarborough, one abandoned mall was taken over by a kind of a flea market where small-time traders could have an opportunity to sell their goods. And in one abandoned parking lot, a Tamil architect was setting up a night market to serve as a kind of social space for his community. So I guess my question is then, is this a kind of itself insurgent citizenship, or do we need to see it simply in the more negative light of the kind of neoliberal kind of flight of capital?
Well, because I believe in agency so much that my whole understanding as a political scientist is about, you know, is driven by this, I would never say this is just, you know, the outcome of structural forces that create the neoliberal city and hence we have this and that. But I do think that the agency that is created here is a bit more complicated than what is usually being envisioned. So number one, people will not behave like a Tiburtian citizen. People don't even know who that is. People who come to Toronto now don't behave like a typical market individual, isolated kind of person. As you know, I must have read every book about LA and how LA is being envisioned. That's how LA was envisioned. That's how we end up with 84 cities or 88 now in LA County. That is how people thought. People believed the world worked, but you cannot say that in a city of almost 3 million, where, you know, more than half immigrants come to that. I had no idea when I, as an immigrant, came to Toronto, I wasn't thinking about community and that in those things. And I'm sure that the South Asian and East Asian immigrants that are now in the majority that come to Toronto think in these terms. So their agency is probably different from what we think it is. So that, to be said, has to be said in the beginning. So when they experience a certain everyday suburbanism by running a small shop at in a, one of those mini malls, they have certain real needs. They want to pay low taxes, and they want to make sure that their kids go to better schools that they went to, and they have a better life than they have. They want to be somewhat safe, and they don't want their male kids to end up in gangs, and they, you know, have all kinds of ideas about how they want to live in this particular neighborhood. That doesn't translate it automatically in a particular kind of politics. So the proletarianization issue, it's not actually proletarianization, because actually what it is, it's small merchandization to many of those people. And it's half the family has some job like that. The other half the family tends to have jobs in, you called it, Frank, following the Rotman School, the service class, right? That's what we call it now. So these are people in the service class. They have that class, race, immigration status doesn't, and gender, a lot of the poverty is female, that doesn't easily translate into a newer type to one new type of politics. So I had this one up, and I didn't take the time to explain it, but I'll do it now, because I wanted to show the actual changes happened around here, right? But as I already said, I couldn't show that map for technical reasons. So I wanted to take this. This is the Don Valley is around here. Some of the most the densest, most populous immigrant neighborhoods are in that area, and it's part of that newly impoverished third city that Holchansky is talking about. There was a provincial election a few years ago where Kathleen Wynne, who is a left liberal politician, she's also a lesbian, which is important in this case. She comes from the radical school movement in Toronto, and is now the Minister of Education or Transportation, but she used to be the Minister of Education, beat out John Tory, the leader of the Conservative Party, who is a red Tory, progressive conservative. She beat him out, and he had as the wedge issue the idea of religious schools that he favored. So a lesbian left-wing liberal beats out a Tory who's called Tory, who caters to these what he thought were these conservative ideas amongst the Muslim community, which is in these towers, right? He gambled. He actually is now not a politician anymore because he misgambled. In that same area, Don Valley West and Don Valley East, now the Tories, the Conservatives, won the gamble in this last election. So what I'm trying to say is that the political identities, both individual and community, are just beginning to form. They are, to some degree, led by the Canadian political system, so that you expect different things to happen at the municipal level and at the provincial level and the federal level. So people play that game in a particular way. I don't know whether they do this, as was discussed earlier, knowing that one is more or less important. I don't know whether people have that idea. But they form a new political community that is now an agent and a stakeholder in the political process that is just beginning to emerge. And they're not neatly fitting into what is being presented to them. What will come out of this is an empirical question. It's one that we will experience over the next little while. Because up here, an NDP person won, so we don't know which way this is going to go. It's unclear how the political process will produce new political actors and new claims that will be attached to particular issues that are not just on the horizon. And that's, for me, just as interesting as the political economy of those mini malls that you were talking about, because the mini malls themselves, and that can go either way. It can go produce new forms of authoritarianism. It can also produce new forms of democracy. But it is a real political process with real political actors who are not just, and that is, of course, something that people have said in critique of that, and I understand you to say similar things in your paper this morning, is that Holshansky's map can be taken quite the wrong way to say, look at these people. These are here the poor people, here's the rich people. And this is that this city, and here's that city, and they will behave this way, and they will behave that way. And there is a certain preconceived understanding of what that landscape translates into when it comes to political discourse. And I think that is wrong, and I think we need to keep our eyes open to see where we're going with this.
I guess this falls on the previous questions. Right, and so I think it's an agency type question. So when I was reading the paper, I saw sort of the various forms of governance, right, and emerging forms of governance. And one was one of the concerns that you have is about the force of capital and the inability of the state to resist these flows of capital, right? And so then I thought, okay, right, so the state can't resist flows of capital, maybe it has a regulatory function. And then in the next paragraph, like, you talk about the authoritarian and privatized nature of the state, right? So I guess the question is, in what forms do you imagine agency to sort of resist these kinds of forces, if at all, right? Because it seems to me that the state in its function as a kind of redistributive entity can't resist capital flows. The state as a regulatory entity is captured, right? And so what I've heard in your responses to the various questions is essentially three possibilities. One, a kind of design possibility, right? So you say, we would have better outcomes if we were designed this way. Right. Second possibility is this thing about new emergent political affiliations and ways of engagement, and this third thing, the workshops in changing the way people conceive of politics. And I guess my question is, none of these three forces seem to be sufficient to the task of changing things, given the force of given the neoliberal forces that you've identified. So should we all just give up?
Well, no, of course not. But also let's not mix up our analytical research design with the reality. I mean, these are two different things. We're not saying that's a political program. This is a research design. We're looking through the modalities of the state capital accumulation and these private. By the way, it's not the state that's authoritarian. It's those new forms of governance that are authoritarian. Use gated communities as the example of that, but there are many other governmentalities that are often in civil society, don't need to be in the state. And they're all very, they interact. Not all of them are negative. There are aspects of capital accumulation that have, that's a question of the right to capital. I like that idea, and I'll integrate that idea. The question is whether some of those areas are actually undercapitalized is an important political question in my mind. The state can do incredibly good things. I think Transit City and the Tower Renewal Project in Toronto are two wonderful initiatives that the ex-municipal government used to have. There are many opportunities for the state to be a positive actor like they were in the past, to create some form of structure. I also think that one can take on these private authoritarian governmentalities. You can take them on at every street corner, basically. You can take them on in the mall. We had this discussion earlier. The mall is part of that landscape of private authoritarianism. What I find more difficult, increasingly difficult, is not the challenge in the political arena when I have room to speak, but the problem is those places where one doesn't have room to speak. And I mean that in such a way that the danger are those preconceived understanding of what it means to be a citizen in Canada. And that means that there are certain ideas about home ownership, for example, that are absolutely central to this idea of private authoritarianism. There are other countries in the world like Switzerland, which is also not the most happiest place on earth. They don't like immigrants very well, very much. They have just passed a law against mosques and these sort of things. But in Switzerland, when you're a tenant, you're considered a citizen. In Toronto, when you're a tenant, you're considered a second-class citizen, right? And that is an understanding of who is political and what is political and what makes you a valued and valuable citizen. That I find very, very hard to combat. I find it hard to understand. I find it very difficult to devise you know, forms of influence by which we as political actors and theorists and teachers can actually get into that arena to say, if you're an immigrant to Canada, it'll be okay for you if you never become a homeowner. You have citizenship rights. There should be, you know, you should know that it's okay not to do this or not to do that. And that I find very difficult.
Can I ask you a question about Arcade Fire?
Sure. Go ahead.
Is the album interpreted as a by people in Canada as an authentic statement of suburban existence, or is it interpreted as Montreal's residents' stereotypical views of what suburbs are like?
These guys are from Houston, you know that?
Yeah.
They grew up in Houston.
No,
the two brothers. You cannot ask me any questions about what Canada thinks about the Arcade Fire, apart from the fact that I did go to the Juno nomination, to the Juno celebration in Canada, because I'm a fan of the Arcade Fire, and I saw them play at, they got Canada's most important music prize. That I can say. I don't know what Canadians think. I don't know what 20-year-olds think when they listen to the Arcade Fire. I don't know what people my age think about when they listen to the Arcade Fire. But I personally think, that's totally off topic, I think it's a great artistic statement. What I would have liked, now that you asked me that question, is to show you some of the possibilities. If you see the Spike Jonze video, have you seen that Spike Jonze video that the images are from here? You should all show this video. It's if you Google Spike Jonze, J-O-N-Z-E, this will come up, or go to the arcadefire.com website. This is a dystopian video about the suburbs. I can guarantee you, you can start every class, every course on political theory with showing this 5-minute video. And there you see something about North America. Not Canadian, it's actually, you know, made in the United States. But you can see something meaningful about the North American suburb. The other interesting thing about Arcade Fire and what it tells you about your world is you can go to the other Arcade Fire video, the interactive one, which you can only enter through Google Chrome, and you put in your address. I don't know if you've done that. Has anybody done this? And it's an amazing thing. You can put in your address, and it takes you to where you grew up or where you live, and it shows you the bird's eye view of where you want to be, and it takes you through the street, running through your own street to the to a song by the Arcade Fire. And the interesting thing about that is, it's extremely scary, but it's extremely effective as, and that's the last thing I'm going to say about this, because it is an interactive music video which for the first time puts you into the middle of something that is otherwise only coming at your ears. And the advantages of that are for teaching purposes and for understanding purposes of what it means, because you can do that when you have a class of 20, potentially with 20, you can do it 20 times, and people will understand how differently your world looks from above and how differently it looks when you run through the streets of that world. And I think this is a moment of public entertainment which you have once a decade. You had, you know, the Talking Heads in the 80s did similar kinds of things. You had something like Nirvana in the 1990s, and now you have this in this decade, in which a moment of aesthetic production and epistemological progress are walking step in step. Now you got your answer. Sorry.
I feel an Arcade Fire in a philosophy volume.
I'm sure it's already been done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.